Girl, there's a better life for me and you. Oh, yes, I know there is. But we might not get to it in this life. Of course we will. We're Americans, darn it. We'll just pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and get it on, as Wayne Gross said one time. Just have to get it on. I don't know how many months ago we were having a discussion about the impending global collapse. And everybody's, well, it's really weird. I think part of this is that people just get numb listening to this stuff. Just like, oh, God. All right. Surveillance state. All right. Global financial collapse. Okay. Shut up about it. No, can't do it. Impossible, totally. A few months ago, I mentioned that, might even been years now, who knows? It's that whole quickening thing. Time going by so fast. For everybody, really. What if, well, let me get this straight. China loans us lots and lots of money. China is the great big industrial heir apparent to the empire, right? United States doesn't really produce that much stuff anymore. Everything you buy at this, not everything, but 99% of it that you buy at whatever store you're going to, made in China right there on the back. And they're loaning us money. And what are we spending that money on? Ah, I know. We're spending it on the military industrial complex's various projects. And what are these projects? Well, drones. Yeah, drones. To be used against our enemies? Well, yeah, them too, but some of them are designed to be used against us. It's like, that doesn't seem like a very good scenario, because if that's all we're really producing, then what happens when all of those bills come due, meaning the bill that comes due on repay and the debt to the Chinese? Or in other words, from this Sierra Hotel, TangoFoxtrotPlan.com, the United States, Europe, China, and all the world's developed economies are, if officials are to be believed, completely immune to what happened in Cyprus. You know what happened in Cyprus? Well, look it up. The current belief by the best and brightest is that these countries are simply too big to ever be faced with the total collapse of their banking systems. But what if they're wrong? What if private debt reached such obscene levels that the loans taken on by lenders could never be repaid? What if a country like China, which holds trillions of dollars in cash reserves and has modern central banking regulations, what if they did face such a problem? Couldn't happen, right? It turns out that's exactly what's happening right now, as Chinese banks struggle to cope with nearly $23 trillion worth of potentially bad loans. Well, I don't know about you, but if I were China, I can't imagine that I would ever have walked into a scenario like that. But apparently they have. So, when the money runs out, then the technology fails, and then disaster strikes. Matt Stein has a couple of books here. When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. And another book, When Disaster Strikes, A Comprehensive Guide for Emergency Planning and Crisis Survival. Hey, you know, better to know it and not need it than to need it and not know anything, right? We'll be right back with Matt Stein on Coast to Coast AM. Matthew Stein is a design engineer, green builder, and author of two best-selling books. The aforementioned ones, When Disaster Strikes, A Comprehensive Guide to Emergency Planning and Crisis Survival, and When Technology Fails. Like trying to get through the Caravan to Midnight site a while ago to read that letter. When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. He's a graduate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that's MIT, where he majored in mechanical engineering. An active mountain climber, serves as a guide and instructor for blind skiers, has written several articles on the subject of sustainable living, and is a guest columnist for the Huffington Post. Welcome back to the program, Matt. Good to have you.
Oh, John, it's always just so great to be on Coast to Coast. It's really my favorite show that out of all the hundreds I've done, Coast to Coast is the best.
Well, thanks for that. I'll tell you, it's my favorite show, too, because we get to get crazy with it sometimes, and I love that. The good crazy. We leave the bad crazy to the other ones. Thank you very much for sending these books along. These are great. These are heavy duty, chock full of information, and a lot of it really I never thought of. I thought I had it all covered, but no.
Yeah, I mean, it you've got like 3 years in When Tech Fails is huge. It's like phone book sized, and it has 3 years of my life in that, and all the equity of my home went into putting that on paper. And
your opus.
It's my opus. That's right. It's my cosmic homework assignment. You know, when back in 1997, I'd never considered writing anything remotely like When Technology Fails. But at that point in time, I'd had a then 20-year practice of mostly daily prayer and meditation, and not fanatic, but a nice way to start my day. And roughly Thanksgiving of 1997, I had my morning session, and I just said, okay, guide me. Very generic question. You know, God, could you give me guidance and inspiration? And I got a bomb dropped in my lap that morning. All of a sudden, into my head, I got this cosmic download, instantaneous download of a massive outline. It came in a storyboard format inside my head, outlining this huge book project. And my first thought was like, no effing way. I mean, I don't know all this stuff. I can't do it. And Jesus calls it the still small voice. The little voice in my head said, well, nobody knows it all. And it assured me that I had the skills and talents that if I took the assignment on, and it always felt much more like my assignment than my idea, that I'd get the inner and outer help I needed to finish it off, meaning that outer help, meaning I'd dig up all the books and resource materials and other experts to help me fill in the blanks in the different chapters. And, you know, some of the areas I'm a genuine expert, but not all of them. And inner help, meaning that throughout the whole process, the same voice that was guiding me then and had downloaded this roughly 30-page pictorial, moving three-dimensional outline into my head would step in now and then and help me with the writing process to, you know, kind of point me where to go and where I shouldn't go and where I should go. So it was a very interesting process, and I didn't just jump right up and say, you know, God talked to me today and I got to do this book. It was like, it took me a year to decide that maybe it was a good idea and I could actually do it, and another year to write a proposal and find a publisher willing to sign on the line, and then the third year to really bite the bullet and rack up the credit cards and put my engineering design business on hold and work 70 hours a week and bring it to completion. So it was a huge process. And then in 2008, I put a whole nother year of labor into a massive update and expansion of the book in 2008.
And then you also have this one called Geronimo the Frog.
Yeah. It's a little different. Geronimo the Frog. Well, that kind of sounds like When Technology Fails, right?
Yes.
When my daughter was a little girl, back in like around 1989, I made up this really, really cool story about a frog and some party animals that are trashing the swamp where the frog lives, and how he decides to defend the swamp with all of his animal buddies, and it's really exciting. It was really cool. My daughter just squealed with delight, and her neighbor, who was like 3 years old at the time, Marissa, she just loved the story too. And I kind of thought, you know, I should write this down someday, because this is a really great story and these kids loved it. But 5 years went by and I did nothing. And I was in Las Vegas on a business trip, you know, with some experimental drinking fountain valves that I designed and were being troubleshot in Vegas on the terrible drinking water down there with all the salts and things. It was a good place to do that. And I went to sleep at night after working on these fountain valves all day. And at 11 o'clock at night, I get yanked out of my sleep with this voice in my head saying, stop procrastinating and write Geronimo down now. You know, it's like, I mean, I'd only procrastinated for 5 years. So I couldn't sleep. And I just, you know, woke up and got a yellow pad and worked until about 4 in the morning on the draft for Geronimo the Frog, this children's story. And finally, 4, I kind of asked inside, like, okay, it's done. Can I sleep? And it's like, yeah, you can sleep. So I went to sleep and woke up in the morning and went and finished my work on the valves. And I'm sitting in the airport and thinking, like, how the hell am I going to find the Native American names for the animals in this story? I mean, I knew I wanted Native American names, and I didn't even remember the name of the tribe in Florida, much less how I could contact someone. So I'm sitting in the airport thinking, like, oh, man, how am I going to do this? And I get on the plane and sit down in my seat, and this silver-haired, stunning lady is walking down the aisle, and she's just decked out with, like, the most amazing Indian jewelry I'd ever seen in my life, just fully decked out, just incredible jewelry. And she sits down beside me, and I notice she's carrying this book on Native American Sign Language, so I strike up a conversation, and it turns out that she was full-blooded Cherokee, born on the res, had a couple get knocked up with a couple kids, very young, divorced, single mom, got in a government program, went to school, got a PhD and became a college professor, and she wrote that book. So I get all excited, and I start telling her about getting yanked out of sleep and, you know, Geronimo the Frog, being told I had to stop procrastinating and write it down. And then I said, would you happen to know how I might be able to find the Native American names from the tribe? And I didn't even know the name of the tribe in Florida. And she said, yeah, I was on the Seminole Indian Reservation in Florida last week, and I'll give you the name of two elders to contact. And she said, and so it's totally clear that our meeting is not coincidence. It's prearranged on a cosmic level, and you have to write this book. And so she gave me the name of the elders, and I got a hold of one. They worked with me for the names of the kids and wrote the book and tried selling it to publishers. And, you know, I had little kids at the time, an engineering department to run, so I just kind of tried selling it for a while and then sort of lost steam and gave up. But last winter, when my wife was very sick with cancer and I was spending a lot of time in the hospitals and doing things, I thought, you know, I want to do something fun too. So I had this kids book already written, and I had some cash from expert witness work, and I thought, you know, I'm going to make Geronimo the Frog happen. So it finally happened a month ago, or a couple months back, it came out. And yeah. So that's how come I wrote a children's book, you know, all these gloom and doom books, and I got Geronimo the Frog to go alongside him.
Now, I have to ask, not because it's my business, but I'm just interested. How is the wife?
She died.
She passed away.
Yeah, she died on December 22nd, 3 days before Christmas. It was devastating.
This past December?
Yep. Yeah, one month and 3 days ago.
Madam, I'm sorry. Deepest condolences. And now, I was hoping you might say something else, but I can only imagine how you must feel. But you know, she's just gone back to the Lord. It'll be all right. You'll meet again. I'm sure of it.
We will meet again. I mean, she was a phenomenal person. And she was a gifted hypnotherapist. And so there's tons of stories from her work with clients of people. She helped clients actually communicate with people who'd passed over, you know, with mates who'd passed over, or children or parents. And she had confirmation herself in her work from one of her clients. We both, and I've experienced multiple past lives. So here I am, an MIT geek, and I've had all these phenomenal spiritual experiences in my life that blew my mind on many different occasions, including experiencing dozens of past lives myself. So in spite of knowing all that, and I know that she's on the other side, she's doing fine, and she even got to communicate through one of her clients with her father. It was a really strange story. A lady came in, a stockbroker, and said, when I was writing When Technology Fails, actually, we were sharing an office in downtown with some massage therapists on one floor and some master social work counselors. My wife shared an office with them, and I had a space inside where I could work 70 hours a week on my book. I knew I'd be too interrupted at home to do that. And this lady came in and said, I'd like a hypnosis session. And my wife says, well, okay, what do you want to work on? Because, you know, people come to me because they have issues. He said, well, my life's perfect. You know, I make tons of money. I got a wonderful husband. But she says, I'm pregnant, and I'm going to have a child in a few months. And do you think we could contact the spirit of my yet-to-be-born child? And my wife said, well, you know, I've done similar things, not exactly the same, but I think we stand a good chance at it. And so they did, and they had a mind-blowing session when this child came through and said, you know, I, She said, the child said, this is the spirit of the child speaking inside the woman, the client's head during hypnosis, and she'd repeat out loud what the child was saying, and then they'd ask a question, and the child would answer in her head, and she'd repeat the answer out loud. And he said, I know this might be a little weird, but it's coast to coast, so I'm sure I can go into this. And,
bring it on, man.
So the child said, well, I made you want a massage because I knew Josie's cards are there. And then the lady says to Lori, to my wife, she says, oh, he's saying he really, really likes you. Like, he really likes you. And he said that we were all together in this ancient spiritual community in northern Greece where we worship the gods of Horus and Isis, these Egyptian gods. And that he was the spiritual master of the community, and we were all, like, you know, part of the community with him. And they're thinking this is kind of weird. But he's like Johnny Carson. He's like an amazing personality running this show. And then he says, at the end of the session, there's another part to the story, too, that's phenomenal. I can't tell everything for, you know, there's some really cool stuff I just can't say on the air for privacy reasons. But
right.
Towards the end of the session, he says, now, Josie, you have some questions you haven't asked yet. And Josie says, well, no, the session's about my clients, not about me. So then he says, Youp is here. Now, that morning, Youp is... My wife was Dutch Indonesian. She was born in Holland. Her mom was Indonesian. Her dad was a Dutch resistance fighter. They met during the Indonesian Revolution when the queen sent him down to Indonesia to fight the revolution. And he had died the year before, and my wife had had an emotional meltdown that morning where she'd been lying on the floor crying for her daddy like a baby and clutching the teddy bear that she had brought from Holland with her, and that she'd held when Joseph was in America for a year looking for work and starving and trying to find work. He only had a third grade education, so he was on his last legs before he finally found somebody wrote an article about him in the Chronicle. He'd saved all these Jews. He'd been captured and tortured and sentenced to death by Nazis, and now he was in America and couldn't find a job. A phenomenal story. Anyway, so she'd been having this meltdown and calling for her daddy like a little kid, little girl, and clutching her teddy bear that morning. So here's this spirit of the yet-to-be-born child of the stockbroker from San Francisco that's never met my wife before ever in her life until this morning and of the session. And he says, I have a message from Youp for you. And Youp is Josie's dad's name in Dutch. And the only people in America that knew him as Youp and not Joseph Justin was the Dutch Indonesian immigrant crowd. You know, to the public, he was known as Joseph. So only the Dutch Indos knew him as Youp. So here's this lady who's never met Josie before in her life from San Francisco. We're 200 miles away up in Tahoe doing a session, and Youp is giving her messages. And he says, honey, I saw you this morning when you were crying for me, and I wanted to put my arms around you and hold you, but I have no arms anymore. But know that I love you, and I'm doing just fine, and don't worry about me, and I'll be checking in on you, and I'll be helping and guiding you now and then. So just, you know, you're doing great, baby, and I wish I could hold you, but I can't, but know that I love you. And so both my wife and I have the direct experiences of messages from the other side and multiple lifetimes and the immortality of the soul, but it was still damn painful with losing my wife. Still hard. I'm still struggling with it.
I can imagine. Wow. What an extraordinary story. You know that Robert Lanza up there at Wake Forest, and his biocentrics thing, he says, death doesn't exist as we think it does. It doesn't. I can prove it. It's like, you can prove it? Okay. And he seems to have done a pretty good job of proving it on a quantum physical level. So
nice.
That's the bright side.
Lake Tahoe?
No, Carolina, I reckon.
Oh, Lake Forest, Carolina. Okay.
Yep. All right. Well, let's take a little break, and what a remarkable story. There are more, and they are real. It's not some figment of somebody's imagination. These things happen. We know ever so much less than what is to be known, don't you find? We'll be right back with Matt Stein. We'll get into all this EMP, solar flares, grid collapse, nuclear Armageddon. Good grief. Here it comes on Coast to Coast AM. All right. Several people said we went to your site, caravantomidnight.com, and tried to find that letter, but the site was down. That's because you all rushed it. And it's okay. It's back up and running now, at least for a little while. If you're wondering what letter I'm talking about, it's a letter from Dr. Minoru Kawamoto, 93 years old. I spoke to him day before yesterday. And this letter is one that he presented to the Japanese government after becoming friends with Dr. Alvin Weinberg, director of Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Dr. Kawamoto was so successful at rebuilding the highway system in Japan following World War II, and then being in charge of constructing the first oil refinery in Japan, he was also commissioned to introduce nuclear power to Japan. And this is a letter he wrote and presented to the Japanese government in 1957, advising against it. So if you go to caravantomidnight.com, click on news, click on red alert, you'll see it right up there at the top. Now here's the thing. Each of us who sits in the left seat of the mothership here, that is Coast to Coast AM, we present this information. We can't do anything alone, really, except present information. We're the quarterbacks. You're the wide receivers. We'll get you the ball. You got to get it to the end zone. Okay? Okay. Back in a second with Matt Stein. And a little bit later on the program, I'll tell you how to make your tea, your proper cup of tea, creamy. Ever heard of creamy tea? Well, you've had a latte, but it's got coffee in it. This is creamy tea. I'll put you wise to it shortly. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, Matt Stein, let's kick it off with this one. You recently wrote an article called 400 Chernobyls. Is that what we have on our hands? Could something like this actually happen, or has it already happened and we just don't know it yet?
Well, it's definitely not already happened. What we've got is a preview of it from Fukushima and Chernobyl. And what it is, see, it's interesting how it all happened. When I was writing the draft for When Disaster Strikes, was pre-Fukushima, and I finished the last chapter, which is the unthinkable, surviving the nuclear catastrophe. I finished the draft in that chapter 3 days before Chernobyl. And then 2 weeks earlier, I'd finished the draft for the next to the last chapter called EMP and Solar Storms. So the subtitle to my 400 Chernobyls article is EMP, Solar Storms, and Nuclear Armageddon. So after Chernobyl hit, I was on like 25 radio shows the next week. And I was talking about, I mean, not Chernobyl, but Fukushima. And I was talking about the failure mechanism in Fukushima, how it wasn't the earthquake directly that caused the nuclear plant to go critical and melt down, at least according to the official report. It was the loss of power that caused the backup pumping systems that are supposed to kick in. See, a nuclear power plant, when the power grid goes down, the plant goes into emergency shutdown and starts shutting itself down and disconnects from the grid because it can't power itself, because that'd be like trying to take a sip out of a fire hose. You know, the amount of power coming out of a nuclear power plant is too huge. So you can't like just turn that power back around to drive its own cooling pumps. It's like way overkill. It can't handle that. So when the grid goes down, automatically all nuclear power plants in the world are designed to go into emergency shutdown mode, and they have backup pumps that kick in and keep the cooling water flowing through the nuclear power plant so it doesn't melt down.
Right.
So in Fukushima, they had 4 out of the 6 reactors going, and when the earthquake hit, grid goes down, and they all go switch on their backup pumps. Everything's going fine. Well, 20 minutes later, the tsunami comes along and wipes out all but one of the backup power generating systems that provided. They had all of them were on the downslope ocean side except for one. So the number 6 reactor had a functioning generator that kept going to keep the pumps going. And they were able to shuttle number 6 down to number 5 to keep those number 5 from only a partial meltdown. But out of the other 4, 2 of them were operational, and they lost their backup power, and so they went into full meltdown. Well, in the same show on the radio, I'm talking about long-term power outages due to either an EMP, electromagnetic pulse from the sun, I mean, from like a nuclear device that's blown off, 5 to 150 miles above the planet of the Earth, and it causes electromagnetic pulse that fries lots of electronics. And I'll get into more details on that in a little bit. Or a solar storm, a super solar storm, which is similar but not the same to an EMP, and it causes an extreme disturbance that will fry these massive transformers that the grid are dependent upon. And you're looking at a power-down situation of months to years from EMP and solar storm, especially a solar storm, extreme solar storm. So some caller calls in and says, well, Mr. Stein, I don't have an MIT degree like you do, but, you know, one part of the show you're talking about this extremely long grid-down situation, and another part you're talking about the failure of the power plants at Fukushima. And to me it would seem that that's like a really bad scene where you're going to have nuclear power plants melting down all over. My jaw drops. And that's part of the reason we're in this problem today is a lot of engineers like me, they get tunnel vision. And here I'd written these two chapters 2 weeks apart, and I hadn't drawn the lines between the two of them. It's like, oh, I can't believe it. I missed it. You're right. In that event, what you're going to have is all these power plants are mandated to have a week's worth of fuel on hand to keep the pumps going in the event of a grid down. And we assume that the grid is never going to be down for more than a few days. And, you know, and if it is, then they can send a big truck of diesel fuel over to that power plant and keep things going. But when you're talking about an extreme solar event that fries 350 or more of these massive extra high voltage transformers that our grid is totally dependent upon, and that's what the Meditech test funded by U.S. government and the EMP Commission, and it was vetted by the Oak Ridge National Labs and the National Science Foundation. They did this study of what would happen if we had a 1921-style extreme solar storm. Now, that was 1921 is like 95 years ago, and before that, they had an even bigger solar storm in 1859 called the Carrington event. So here in the last 155 years, we've had two massive solar storms that if they happen today, would shatter the grid for months to years in the United States and over most of the northern and southern hemispheres, except for the deep tropical zones. And these, now people say, well, okay, so what if we fry a few of these transformers, right? You can just go down to the hardware store and buy a transformer, right? Well, it's like, no. These transformers, called extra high voltage transformers, they step volts up and down to 350 to a million volts. And there's a three-year waiting list to buy a single one now. And the entire world's production in a year is like, 100 of these, or so in a year. And we're talking 350, a couple thousand worldwide would be destroyed and fried if we had a storm along the size that scientists tell us happens statistically every 75 to 100 years. Now, it's been 90 years since the last one. So... And it's been 75 to 100 years guaranteed. So this is a guaranteed to happen event.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like an asteroid where, 40 million years ago, an asteroid hit the Yucatan Peninsula and wiped out the dinosaurs. Well, 40 million years between events is a long time. Yeah. I'm really not that worried about a 40 million year event happening in my lifetime.
Right.
But something that happens every 75 to 100 years, and it's been 90 years since the last one, well, that's a pretty significant concern.
Yes, I would think so. Yeah, with, if it's an asteroid, you could stick your tongue out and do that. Yeah, you missed me.
Right.
But
yeah,
not this.
I'll stick around another million years or 10 million years and maybe it'll happen again, right? But I'm not too worried about it. But something, so statistically, we have a 1 in 8 chance every decade of one of these crippling electromagnetic events from happening. And since we're due or overdue, depending on, how the math strikes out, it's not an exact science. This is a significant event. Now, there's a good news and bad news part to this story. So the bad news is that if it happens, and we're currently totally unprepared, it will fry the grid. Most of America will starve, and probably most of the 104 nuclear reactors in America will go Fukushima style. And 37% of all Americans live within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant. So they build these power plants. They build them outside of town by a few miles so people aren't too freaked out. But they don't build them really far away because transporting the huge amount of power from that a nuclear power plant puts out over distance, you have transmission losses, and that's dollars down the drain. So they try to build them close enough to the cities that they don't waste a lot of money in transmission losses, but far enough away that people don't freak out. But if you live in New York City and Indian Point goes down, and what's that, like 10 miles out of town, you're talking New York City will be poisoned by the cesium for only the next 60 years. Don't worry, you can move back into New York City in 60 years. It'll be everything's going to be okay. You just have to wait around 60 years to move back. Now, if you look at the map, and if you go to, if you want the details, like my whole 400 Chernobyls went really viral on the internet, and it's posted on Huffington Post and Alternet, and several places. But the full complete article with all of the hot links to all of the documents I used to put this together is available at my website, whentechfails.com. And if you're really worried about this, then you really need to go there. And because it's a real problem. Now, the good news is, for the price of a single B-2 bomber, a single stealth bomber, like those things that we got 21 of them or two of them left in our fleet, a tiny fraction of what we bailed the banks out on Wall Street, the technology's already been invented to protect the grid from an extreme solar storm event. And it's only about $1 to $2 billion. $2 billion is the price of a B-2 bomber. Like I said, we bail out Wall Street for like $500 billion, and so this is a tiny fraction of that. And some say it was actually more like 6 to 7, times that amount, that the official amount. But it was a huge number. And so for a relatively small number, too big for you and me to pay for it, but relatively small number on governments, we could protect the grid. Now the bad news is that when the Shield Act came up in Congress, it recommended that private industry foot the bill for this couple billion bucks to fix the grid. And there's a company called NERC, North American Electric Reliability Corporation. Sounds like good guys that they're out there to protect us. Well, they're sort of good guys. They are kind of out there to protect us, but they looked at this and they said, wow, that's a lot of money for us to spend out of our own pocket. And the Shield Act says that if we don't manage to recoup that money from our clientele, then, a couple years later, we can come back to Congress and ask them for some money to help us out. So what did they do? Well, they wrote a new report, and they said, we looked at the data, and everything's okay. It's like, I believe in tooth fairies and Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. Everything's okay. We looked at the data and decided that we're totally adequately protected on the grid, and you don't have to worry about this. And so they paid their lobbyists to go to Congress and tell them, don't worry, you don't need to do Shield Act. Everything's fine, because they didn't want to spend the $2 billion. So it's kind of like for 50 years, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers told the politicians, New Orleans is a disaster waiting to happen. These levees are not adequate to hold up to a Category 3 or stronger storm. It's not a question of if a hurricane like that's going to hit New Orleans. It's a question of when will it hit New Orleans. Nobody knows when it's going to hit. So we're in that same boat right now. It's a guaranteed event that we're going to have an extreme solar storm. They happen. Ice core samplings for the last 20,000 years show these things happen, and they happen in average of 70 to 100 years apart. Could be two of them 5 years apart, could be two of them 200 years apart, but they guaranteed to happen. And we're due for one. So it's a guaranteed event. And if the world ended because we didn't get off our behinds and spend the $2 billion to protect the grid, and we had dozens or 100 Fukushima-like events happening across America, and it wiped out mammalian life and people and certainly civilization across the planet because we didn't spend the $2 billion, it'll be a lot of people saying, gee, I guess we should have done that. So one of the things as Coast to Coast listeners you can do is you can get active. And at the end of my 400 Chernobyls article are links to how you can, get active and do something. And then the other thing you can do is hopefully we don't have a worst-case scenario like that, put your head between your knees and kiss your you-know-what goodbye. But there, in the chapters, both on surviving a nuclear catastrophe and on EMPs and solar storms, there are prepping and survival strategies, and those chapters are in When Disaster Strikes. These are brand new chapters, brand new material. It didn't exist in When Technology Fails. So, so there's definite differences. There's some overlap between the two books, but like the second half of When Disaster Strikes is totally all 100% brand new material that's not contained in When Technology Fails. And so, you know, some people say, well, what's the difference in, between the books? And When Tech Fails was this cosmic homework assignment downloaded into my head. And it's a manual that helps people live more sustainably and self-reliantly while the world's still working well. And it helps you prepare, deal with, and cope with varying levels of things not working well and falling apart. Everything from a ice storm and the grid is down for a week to everything hit the fan and you know, the EMP or solar storm happened and society's collapsed. And how do you... In When Technology Fails, I bring up all these how-to things for, say, 18th century technologies. Because personally, I'd much rather slide back to, say, 18th century technologies rather than caveman days in a Mad Max scenario. So in When Technology Fails, I try to cover first aid, I cover natural healing, I cover, like, how to make a backyard foundry and you know, melt down an engine block and some pistons and cast a horseshoe or a belt buckle if you had to, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, it's a lot of cool information. You hope you'll never need it. And then there's some really great stuff like alternative healing things that can help out tremendously. Like maybe you've got MRSA and the methicillin-resistant staph infection, and they're telling you they got to cut your arm off to save your life. And you look up in my When Tech Fails book, and it says, no, you can make a homemade colloidal silver generator, and the silver is not as fast-acting as a good antibiotic, but it works. A little slower, but it works on everything. And so I know people who personally saved themselves from amputation due to MRSA using colloidal silver. And it's great if you can go to the store and buy it, but you know, you need to have the stuff on hand in your go bag so that if you can't go to the store and things are down, that you have your little portable pharmacy in your go bag and you can make some silver and help stop the diseases that are going like crazy through everybody because they have no access to pharmaceuticals and antibiotics. So, or you've got a antibiotic-resistant bug and you want to save your life or your family's life, you know, your one of your loved ones' life or life of a neighbor, and you've got the stuff on hand to do it. So it was a huge assignment, this cosmic homework assignment, and the guides that gave it to me, I just call them the guides, call them the Holy Spirit, the spirit guides, the masters. They never told me who exactly they were. They didn't sign it and say this is God or Jesus talking to you, but it was clearly a higher power because a term paper in college was like a huge ordeal for me, and this project dumped into my head was like 20 term papers in one, and I read more books. I read twice as many books when I was writing When Technology Fails as I'd read in my entire life put together, you know, college, high school, college, MIT, post-MIT, 20 years, all those years put together, I probably read twice as many books when I was writing When Technology Fails as my entire life. And so you guys have the benefit of all of this massive amount of work and struggle that I put into it and years of my life I put into it, and you guys can go out for $35 or $25 on Amazon and buy it. And so it's a whole lot easier for you guys than it was for me.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about rolling back the clock to about 1850.
Yeah. I'm saying if it comes down to that and things have totally fallen apart, then, well, naturally some of the stuff in the book is information that wasn't available in 1850, but the ability to replicate the technology of the world, yeah, you're probably on your own, or you would on your own it would be hard to do a whole lot, but you and the community, you know, a few other people, it's a lot of people think the lone wolf scenario, but really people are social animals. We do better in groups, and in groups you have a pool of resources and a pool of skills and talents and knowledge. So for instance, in When Technology Fails, I tried to give enough illustrations and information that if someone was handy and technically oriented or good with their hands, that they could, just with what's in the book, replicate it. But each chapter ends in a resource guide, because you know, the...
We just faded him out. You know why? Because we only got 10 seconds. Each chapter ends with a resource guide, and that's where we're going to pick it up when we come back with Matt Stein on Coast to Coast AM.